This is audiobook of the free, esoteric book, The Secrets of Dr. John Richard Tavener, by Dion Fortune. Copyright expired. Preface. The works of Dion Fortune have come full circle. From their creation during the occult renaissance of the early 20th century to the expiration of their copyright in 1997, these works are of significant value to the occult student of today and, we hope, of the future. Both her fiction and non-fiction works are indispensable reading for any serious student of our Western mystery tradition. This book is something that I was fortunate enough to happen upon early in my occult training and represented, to me, what we may all aspire to become. The character of Tavener himself is the epitome of a modern occultist living in the world but not of it, as they say. Although his methods and status as a magician might invite ridicule from others, he himself maintains a separation between the two and is both occultist and well-respected physician, a challenge we all face and aspire to accomplish. This particular book is a collection of stories that Dion Fortune had written with the intent of presenting them by way of a serial for the purpose of magazine publications. Each story represents a specific case, not unlike the stories of Sherlock Holmes from which she apparently draws her style. More than that, each case is a kind of lesson about occultism, whether it is the practice or mispractice of occultism or an explanation of occult laws. As a work of fiction, I hope you enjoy it. As a discussion of occultism, I hope you find it valuable. And as a whole package, I hope you love these stories as much as I do and find pleasure in reading them over and over again. Greg Wotton, New Alexandria Publications. Introduction. By Dion Fortune. These stories may be looked at from two standpoints, and no doubt the standpoint the reader chooses will be dictated by personal taste and previous knowledge of the subject under discussion. They may be regarded as fiction, designed, like the conversation of the fat boy recorded in the Pickwick Papers, to make your flesh creep, or they may be considered to be what they actually are. Studies and little-known aspects of psychology put in the form of fiction because, if published as a serious contribution to science, they would have no chance of a hearing. It may not unreasonably be asked what motive anyone could have for securing a hearing for such histories as are set forth in these tales, beyond the not unreasonable interest in the royalties that usually fall to the lot of those who cater for the popular taste in horrors. I would ask my readers, however, to credit me with another motive than the purely commercial. I was one of the earliest students of psychoanalysis in this country, and I found, in the course of my studies, that the ends of a number of threads were put into my hands, but that the threads disappeared into the darkness that surrounded the small circle of light thrown by exact scientific knowledge. It was in following these threads out into the darkness of the unknown that I came upon the experiences and cases which, turned into fiction, are set down in these pages. I do not wish to imply by that, however, that these stories all happened exactly as set down, for such is not the case. They are, however, all founded on fact, and there is not a single incident herein contained which is pure imagination. That is to say, while no picture is an actual photograph, not one is an imaginary sketch, they are rather composite photographs, obtained by cutting out and piecing together innumerable snapshots of actual happenings, and the whole, far from being an arbitrary product of the imagination, is a serious study in the psychology of ultra-consciousness. I present these studies in supernormal pathology to the general reader because it has been my experience that such cases as I chronicle here are by no manner of means as uncommon as might be supposed, but, being unrecognized, pass unhelped. I have personally come across several instances of the powerhouse, some of which are well known to the members of the different coteries who are interested in these matters. Bloodlust is literally true, and both these stories, far from being written up for the purposes of fiction, have been toned down to make them fit for print. Dr. Tavener will no doubt be recognized by some of my readers. His mysterious nursing home was an actual fact, and infinitely stranger than any fiction could possibly be. It is a curious thing that the picture of him drawn from fancy by the artist who illustrated these stories for the Royal Magazine is a recognizable likeness, although that artist had neither seen a photograph nor had a description of him. to Dr. Taverner I owe the greatest debt of my life. Without Dr. Taverner there would have been no Dion Fortune, and to him I offer the tribute of these pages. Dion Fortune, London. Bloodlust. I have never been able to make up my mind whether Dr. Taverner should be the hero or the villain of these histories. That he was a man of the most selfless ideals could not be questioned, but in his methods of putting these ideals into practice he was absolutely unscrupulous. He did not evade the law, he merely ignored it, and though the exquisite tenderness with which he handled his cases was an education in itself, yet he would use that wonderful psychological method of his to break a soul to pieces, going to work as quietly and methodically and benevolently as if bent upon the cure of his patient. The manner of my meeting with this strange man was quite simple. After being gazetted out of the RAMC, I went to a medical agency and inquired what posts were available. I said, "I have come out of the army with my nerves shattered. I want some quiet place till I can pull myself together." "So does everybody else," said the clerk. He looked at me thoughtfully. "I wonder whether you would care to try a place we have had on our books for some time. We have sent several men down to it but none of them would stop." He sent me round to one of the tributaries of Harley Street, and there I made the acquaintance of the man who, whether he was good or bad, I have always regarded as the greatest mind I ever met. Tall and thin, with a parchment-like countenance, he might have been any age from 35 to 65. I have seen him look both ages within the hour. He lost no time in coming to the point. "I want a medical superintendent for my nursing home," he told me. "I understand that you have specialized, as far as the army permitted you to, in mental cases. I am afraid you will find my methods very different from the orthodox ones. However, as I sometimes succeed where others fail, I consider I am justified in continuing to experiment, which I think, Dr. Rhodes, is all any of my colleagues can claim to do." The man's cynical manner annoyed me, though I could not deny that mental treatment is not an exact science at the present moment. As if in answer to my thought he continued, "My chief interest lies in those regions of psychology which orthodox science has not as yet ventured to explore. If you will work with me you will see some queer things, but all I ask of you is, that you should keep an open mind and a shut mouth." This I undertook to do, for, although I shrank instinctively from the man, yet there was about him such a curious attraction, such a sense of power and adventurous research, that I determined at least to give him the benefit of the doubt and see what it might lead to. His extraordinarily stimulating personality, which seemed to key my brain to concert pitch, made me feel that he might be a good tonic for a man who had lost his grip on life for the time being. "Unless you have elaborate packing to do," he said, "I can motor you down to my place. If you will walk over with me to the garage I will drive you round to your lodgings, pick up your things, and we shall get in before dark." We drove at a pretty high speed down the Portsmouth Road till we came to Thursley, and then, to my surprise, my companion turned off to the right and took the big car by a cart track over the heather. "This is Thorsley or Field," he said, as the blighted country unrolled before us. "The old worship is still kept up about here." "The Catholic faith?" I inquired. "The Catholic faith, my dear sir, is an innovation. I was referring to the pagan worship. The peasants about here still retain bits of the old ritual. They think that it brings them luck, or some such superstition. They have no knowledge of its inner meaning." He paused a moment, and then turned to me and said with extraordinary emphasis, "Have you ever thought what it would mean if a man who had the knowledge could piece that ritual together?" I admitted I had not. I was frankly out of my depth, but he had certainly brought me to the most unchristian spot I had ever been in my life. His nursing home, however, was in delightful contrast to the wild and barren country that surrounded it. The garden was a mass of color, and the house, old and rambling and covered with creepers, as charming within as without. It reminded me of the East, it reminded me of the Renaissance, and yet it had no style save that of warm rich coloring and comfort. I soon settled down to my job, which I found exceedingly interesting. As I have already said, Taverner's work began where ordinary medicine ended, and I have under my care cases such as the ordinary doctor would have referred to the safekeeping of an asylum, as being nothing else but mad. Yet Taverner, by his peculiar methods of work, laid bare causes operating both within the soul and in the shadowy realm where the soul has its dwelling, that threw an entirely new light upon the problem, and often enabled him to rescue a man from the dark influences that were closing in upon him. The affair of the sheep killing was an interesting example of his methods. 2. One showery afternoon at the nursing home we had a call from a neighbor, not a very common occurrence, for Taverner and his ways were regarded somewhat askance. Our visitor shed her dripping mackintosh, but declined to loosen the scarf which, warm as the day was, she had twisted tightly round her neck. "I believe you specialize in mental cases," she said to my colleague. "I should very much like to talk over with you a matter that is troubling me." Taverner nodded, his keen eyes watching her for symptoms. "It concerns a friend of mine, in fact, I think I may call him my fiancé, for, although he has asked me to release him from his engagement, I have refused to do so, not because I should wish to hold a man who no longer loved me, but because I am convinced that he still cares for me, and there is something which has come between us that he will not tell me of. I have begged him to be frank with me and let us share the trouble together, for the thing that seems an insuperable obstacle to him may not appear in that light to me, but you know what men are when they consider their honor is in question." She looked from one to the other of us, smiling. "No woman ever believes that her menfolk are grown up. Perhaps she is right." Then she leant forward and clasped her hands eagerly. "I believe I have found the key to the mystery. I want you to tell me whether it is possible or not." "Will you give me particulars?" said Taverner. "We got engaged while Donald was stationed here for his training, that would be nearly 5 years ago now, and there was always the most perfect harmony between us until he came out of the army, when we all began to notice a change in him. He came to the house as often as ever, but he always seemed to want to avoid being alone with me. We used to take long walks over the moors together, but he has absolutely refused to do this recently. Then, without any warning, he wrote and told me he could not marry me and did not wish to see me again, and he put a curious thing in his letter. He said, 'Even if I should come to you and ask you to see me, I beg you not to do it.' My people thought he had got entangled with some other girl, and were furious with him for jilting me. But I believe there is something more in it than that. I wrote to him, but could get no answer, and I had come to the conclusion that I must try and put the whole thing out of my life, when he suddenly turned up again. Now, this is where the queer part comes in. We heard the fowls shrieking one night, and thought a fox was after them. My brothers turned out armed with golf clubs, and I went too. When we got to the hen house we found several fowl with their throats torn as if a rat had been at them. But the boys discovered that the hen house door had been forced open, a thing no rat could do. They said a gypsy must have been trying to steal the birds, and told me to go back to the house. I was returning by way of the shrubberies when someone suddenly stepped out in front of me. It was quite light, for the moon was nearly full, and I recognized Donald. He held out his arms and I went to him, but, instead of kissing me, he suddenly bent his head and looked. She drew her scarf from her neck and showed us a semicircle of little blue marks on the skin just under the ear, the unmistakable print of human teeth. "He was after the jugular," said Taverner. "Lucky for you he did not break the skin." I said to him, "Donald, what are you doing?" My voice seemed to bring him to himself, and he let me go and tore off through the bushes. The boys chased him but did not catch him, and we have never seen him since. "You have informed the police, I suppose?" said Taverner. "Father told them someone had tried to rob the hen roost, but they do not know who it was. You see, I did not tell them I had seen Donald." "And you walk about the moors by yourself, knowing that he may be lurking in the neighborhood?" She nodded. "I should advise you not to, Miss Winter. The man is probably exceedingly dangerous, especially to you. We will send you back in the car." "You think he has gone mad?" "That is exactly what I think. I believe he knew he was going mad, And that was why he broke off our engagement. Dr. Taverner, is there nothing that can be done for him? It seems to me that Donald is not mad in the ordinary way. We had a housemaid once who went off her head, and the whole of her seemed to be insane, if you can understand. But with Donald it seems as if only a little bit of him were crazy, as if his insanity were outside himself. Can you grasp what I mean? It seems to me you had given a very clear description of a case of psychic interference, what was known in scriptural days as being possessed by a devil, said Taverner. Can you do anything for him? The girl inquired eagerly. I may be able to do a good deal if you can get him to come to me. On our next day at the Harley Street consulting room we found that the butler had booked an appointment for a Captain Donald Craigie. We discovered him to be a personality of singular charm, one of those highly strung, imaginative men who have the makings of an artist in them. In his normal state he must have been a delightful companion, but as he faced us across the consulting room desk he was a man under a cloud. I may as well make a clean breast of this matter, he said. I suppose Beryl told you about their chickens? She told us that you tried to bite her. Did she tell you I bit the chickens? No. Well, I did. Silence fell for a moment. Then Taverner broke it. When did this trouble first start? After I got shell shock. I was blown right out of a trench, and it shook me up pretty badly. I thought I had got off lightly, for I was only in hospital about 10 days. But I suppose this is the aftermath. Are you one of those people who have a horror of blood? Not especially so. I didn't like it, but I could put up with it. We had to get used to it in the trenches. Someone was always getting wounded, even in the quietest times. And killed, put in Taverner. Yes, and killed, said our patient. So you developed a blood hunger? That's about it. Underdone meat and all the rest of it, I suppose. No, that is no use to me. It seems a horrible thing to say, but it is fresh blood that attracts me. Blood as it comes from the veins of my victim. Ah, said Taverner. That puts a different complexion on the case. I shouldn't have thought it could have been much blacker. On the contrary, what you have just told me renders the outlook much more hopeful. You have not so much a bloodlust, which might well be an effect of the subconscious mind, as a vitality hunger, which is quite a different matter. Craigie looked up quickly. That's exactly it. I have never been able to put it into words before, but you have hit the nail on the head. I saw that my colleague's perspicuity had given him great confidence. I should like you to come down to my nursing home for a time and be under my personal observation, said Taverner. I should like to very much, but I think there is something further you ought to know before I do so. This thing has begun to affect my character. At first it seemed something outside myself, but now I am responding to it, almost helping, and trying to find out ways of gratifying it without getting myself into trouble. That is why I went for the hens when I came down to the Winters' house. I was afraid I should lose my self-control and go for Beryl. I did in the end, as it happened, so it was not much use. In fact, I think it did more harm than good, for I seemed to get into a much closer touch with it after I had yielded to the impulse. I know that the best thing I could do would be to do away with myself, but I don't. I feel that after I am dead I should have to meet whatever it is face to face. You need not be afraid to come down to the nursing home, said Taverner. We will look after you. After he had gone, Taverner said to me, have you ever heard of vampires, Rhodes? Yes, rather, I said. I used to read myself to sleep with Dracula once when I had a spell of insomnia. That, nodding his head in the direction of the departing man, is a singularly good specimen. Do you mean to say you are going to take a revolting case like that down to Hindhead? Not revolting, Rhodes. A soul in a dungeon. The soul may not be very savory, but it is a fellow creature. Let it out and it will soon clean itself. I often used to marvel at the wonderful tolerance and compassion Taverner had for erring humanity. The more you see of human nature, he said to me once, the less you feel inclined to condemn it, for you realize how hard it has struggled. No one does wrong because he likes it, but because it is the lesser of the two evils. 3. A couple of days later I was called out of the nursing home office to receive a new patient. It was Craigie. He had got as far as the doormat, and there he had stuck. He seemed so thoroughly ashamed of himself that I had not the heart to administer the judicious bullying which is usual under such circumstances. "I feel as if I were driving a balking horse," he said. "I want to come in, but I can't." I called Taverner, and the sight of him seemed to relieve our patient. "Ah," he said, "you give me confidence. I feel that I can defy it," and he squared his shoulders and crossed the threshold. Once inside, a weight seemed lifted from his mind, and he settled down quite happily to the routine of the place. Beryl Winter used to walk over almost every afternoon, unknown to her family, and cheer him up. In fact, he seemed on the high road to recovery. One morning I was strolling round the grounds with the head gardener, planning certain small improvements, when he made a remark to me which I had reason to remember later. "You would think all the German prisoners should have been returned by now, wouldn't you, sir?" "But they haven't. I passed one the other night in the lane outside the back door. I never thought that I should see their filthy field grey again." I sympathized with his antipathy. He had been a prisoner in their hands, and the memory was not one to fade. I thought no more of his remark, but a few days later I was reminded of it when one of our patients came to me and said, "Dr. Rhodes, I think you are exceedingly unpatriotic to employ German prisoners in the garden when so many discharged soldiers cannot get work." I assured her that we did not do so, no German being likely to survive a day's work under the superintendence of our ex-prisoner head gardener. "But I distinctly saw the man going round the greenhouses at shutting up time last night," she declared. "I recognized him by his flat cap and grey uniform. I mentioned this to Taverner. 'Tell Craigie he is on no account to go out after sundown,' he said, 'and tell Miss Winter she had better keep away for the present.'" A night or two later, as I was strolling round the grounds smoking an after-dinner cigarette, I met Craigie hurrying through the shrubbery. "You will have Dr. Taverner on your trail," I called after him. "I missed the post bag," he replied, "and I am going down to the pillar box." Next evening I again found Craigie in the grounds after dark. I bore down on him. "Look here, Craigie," I said, "if you come to this place you must keep the rules, and Dr. Taverner wants you to stay indoors after sundown." Craigie bared his teeth and snarled at me like a dog. I took him by the arm and marched him into the house and reported the incident to Taverner. "The creature has re-established its influence over him," he said. "We cannot evidently starve it out of existence by keeping it away from him. We shall have to use other methods." "Where is Craigie at the present moment?" "Playing the piano in the drawing room," I replied. "Then we will go up to his room and unseal it." As I followed Taverner upstairs he said to me, "Did it ever occur to you to wonder why Craigie jibbed on the doorstep?" "I paid no attention," I said. "Such a thing is common enough with mental cases. There is a sphere of influence, a kind of psychic bell jar, over this house to keep out evil entities, what might in popular language be called a spell." Craigie's familiar could not come inside, and did not like being left behind. I thought we might be able to tire it out by keeping Craigie away from its influences, but it has got too strong a hold over him, and he deliberately cooperates with it. Evil communications corrupt good manners, and you can't keep company with a thing like that and not be tainted, especially if you are a sensitive Celt like Craigie. When we reached the room, Taverner went over to the window and passed his hand across the sill, as if sweeping something aside. "There," he said. "It can come in now and fetch him out, and we will see what it does." At the doorway he paused again and made a sign on the lintel. "I don't think it will pass that," he said. When I returned to the office I found the village policeman waiting to see me. "I should be glad if you would keep an eye on your dog, sir," he said. "We have been having complaints of sheep king lately, and whatever animal is doing it is working in a 3-mile radius with this as the center." "Our dog is an Airedale," I said. "I should not think he is likely to be guilty. It is usually collies that take to sheep king. At 11 o'clock we turned out the lights and herded our patients off to bed. At Taverner's request I changed into an old suit and rubber-soled tennis shoes and joined him in the smoking room, which was under Craigie's bedroom. We sat in the darkness awaiting events. "I don't want you to do anything," said Taverner, "but just to follow and see what happens." We had not long to wait. In about a quarter of an hour we heard a rustling in the creepers, and down came Craigie hand over fist, swinging himself along by the great ropes of wisteria that clothed the wall. As he disappeared into the shrubbery I slipped after him, keeping in the shadow of the house. He moved at a stealthy dog trot over the heather paths towards Frensham. At first I ran and ducked, taking advantage of every patch of shadow, but presently I saw that this caution was unnecessary. Craigie was absorbed in his own affairs, and thereupon I drew closer to him, following at a distance of some 60 yards. He moved at a swinging pace, a kind of loping trot that put me in mind of a bloodhound. The wide, empty levels of that forsaken country stretched out on either side of us, belts of mist filled the hollows, and the heights of Hindhead stood out against the stars. I felt no nervousness. Man for man, I reckoned I was a match for Craigie, and, in addition, I was armed with what is technically known as a soother, 2 feet of lead gas piping inserted in a length of rubber hose pipe. It is not included in the official equipment of the best asylums, but can frequently be found in a keeper's trouser leg. If I had known what I had to deal with, I should not have put so much reliance on my soother. Ignorance is sometimes an excellent substitute for courage. Suddenly out of the heather ahead of us a sheep got up, and then the chase began. Away went Craigie in pursuit, and away went the terrified wether. A sheep can move remarkably fast for a short distance, but the poor wool-encumbered beast could not keep pace, and Craigie ran it down, working in gradually lessening circles. It stumbled, went to its knees, and he was on it. He pulled its head back, and whether he used a knife or not I could not see, for a cloud passed over the moon, but dimly luminous in the shadow, I saw something that was semi-transparent pass between me and the dark, struggling mass among the heather. As the moon cleared the clouds I made out the flat-topped cap and field grey uniform of the German army. I cannot possibly convey the sickening horror of that sight, the creature that was not a man assisting the man who, for the moment, was not human. Gradually the sheep's struggles weakened and ceased. Craigie straightened his back and stood up, then he set off at his steady lope towards the east, his grey familiar at his heels. How I made the homeward journey I do not know. I dared not look behind lest I should find a presence at my elbow. Every breath of wind that blew across the heather seemed to be cold fingers on my throat. Fir trees reached out long arms to clutch me as I passed under them, and heather bushes rose up and assumed human shapes. I moved like a runner in a nightmare, making prodigious efforts after a receding goal. At last I tore across the moonlit lawns of the house, regardless who might be looking from the windows, burst into the smoking room and flung myself face downwards on the sofa. "Four. Tut, tut," said Taverner. "Has it been as bad as all that?" I could not tell him what I had seen, but he seemed to know. "Which way did Craigie go after he left you?" he asked. "Towards the moonrise," I told him. "And you were on the way to Frensham. He is heading for the Winter's house. This is very serious, Rhodes. We must go after him. It may be too late as it is. Do you feel equal to coming with me?" He gave me a stiff glass of brandy, and we went to get the car out of the garage. In Taverner's company I felt secure. I could understand the confidence he inspired in his patients. Whatever that grey shadow might be, I felt he could deal with it and that I would be safe in his hands. We were not long in approaching our destination. "I think we will leave the car here," said Taverner, turning into a grass-grown lane. "We do not want to rouse them if we can help it." We moved cautiously over the dew-soaked grass into the paddock that bounded one side of the Winter's garden. It was separated from the lawn by a sunk fence, and we could command the whole front of the house and easily gain the terrace if we so desired. In the shadow of a rose pergola we paused. The great trusses of bloom, colourless in the moonlight, seemed a ghastly mockery of our business. For some time we waited, and then the movement caught my eye.